You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next hour we'll be talking about all things food. As usual, I'm joined by my lovely boys. I love saying that because I think it's politically incorrect, probably. Guy Routledge of Sapling Digital and co-founder of The Food Rush.
Good afternoon.
Fresh from being vegan for,
yes,
6 weeks?
About 5-6 weeks, something like that. I now call myself a part-time vegetarian.
God, shall we go into that in a minute? And I'm joined by Ollie Lloyd, who is chief executive of Great British Chefs. We've got next week, we're very excited because we've got all your research coming in, haven't we?
Yeah, it's very interesting.
So I can't wait to do that. Any comments on guys looking slightly thinner? I'm thinking.
I think it's a swimsuit.
Yeah, I wish you wouldn't wear that swimsuit in the studio. It's
okay,
a little bit
message received. Thank you very much.
Also, I believe you sneakily went and got married.
I did, yeah.
Did you know that, Ollie?
When was it? A couple of weeks ago.
Hang on, where did you have your wedding lunch?
I went to Hawksmoor, which is a fabulous steak and seafood place.
What, as a vegan?
No, I'd gone part-time vegetarian by then. We had some amazing, amazing food. Had some scallops roasted in the shell. Had a lovely piece of tomahawk steak. Oh, so good.
I don't really understand vegan versus I'm going to go to Hawksmoor and I'm part-time.
I think if you go to Hawksmoor, you need to be a part-time vegetarian in order to balance things out.
Absolutely right. So we definitely ate too much food.
It's like being a part-time alcoholic.
Well, I think like we're seeing, there's trends everywhere about people reducing meat and, you know, going more plant-based or flexitarian or whatever. So whatever you want to call it, that's kind of what I'm doing as well. So just trying to be a bit more mindful about it. I'm sure we'll see some interesting things in the research next week.
Yeah. And I think, as you say, if you are trying to eat less meat and be more plant-based, when you do actually go and have a steak, it's like, wow.
Yeah, it becomes a special occasion.
And it should be. It should be a special occasion.
Yeah, exactly. So,
we're trying to be nice to him, aren't we, Ollie? We've also got two lovely guests here. We've got Becky Keane from Nirvana Brewery and Alistair Jessel from the Food and Drink Hub. But you may know him better as the man behind Taywell Ice Cream, which is lovely ice cream.
Thank you very much.
That's my pleasure. We're just going to talk to Becky first. Now, Becky, I believe that you founded, along with Steve, Nirvana Brewery, and it's the first non-alcoholic craft brewery in London.
Yeah, that's right.
It's about time, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It's the first non-alcoholic brewery in the UK. First one that we know of in the world, really. But, you know, who knows?
So you've very kindly bought some sort of beer for us to try.
Yeah.
You've got the stuff that you're brewing at the moment. You've got stout, you've got pale ales, you've got an IPA. So you've got a full range there. It's not just one particular type of beer.
We wanted to create something for everyone, something for all different tastes.
And it's got fabulous packaging as well, some really nice illustrations on it. It's all kind of, I may put my foot in it here, but is it kind of, you know, Indian inspired with like Kama Sutra and stuff? Is even the name of one of them, I think, I can just see out of the corner of my eye.
We've got Cosmic, we've got Tantra, Karma and Sutra.
See?
So, I think you're right.
Yeah.
So where did the name come from?
So our main founder, Steve Das, he's originally from India, and it was sort of his creation was the idea of sort of leading a more holistic lifestyle. And so the alcohol-free beers are sort of inspired by the sort of the elements of yoga and mindfulness and that sort of thing.
And I've got some stats here. So since 2004, when we used to drink 9.4 litres, well, that's 20%, 20 pints, sorry, per person, that figure's fallen by 18%. I mean, it really has. There's quite a change, isn't there, in alcohol consumption?
I think they used to refer to that as peak booze. That was the term for that point in history.
I'm still trying to make an effort on that one. The real thing about that market is that the low or no alcohol beer market is estimated to grow from nearly about 63 million a year at the moment to 300 million in 10 years. It's going to be a huge market.
Yeah,
In my view, it hasn't really been cracked that successfully yet. Not by the big brands, I would say. I don't know if you've got experience of the big brands, Ollie.
I don't.
Do you think? I mean, Heineken have just recently really bought one out.
Playing. I mean, you know, I mean, there are the odd brand like Heineken do bring things out in that space. Yeah. But you know, if you take the sort of the craft brewery world, you know, there's been an explosion in the range and numbers of beers that are available on supermarket shelves and, you know, in pubs and, you know, just generally. But in the world of non-alcoholic, I don't think anyone's really...
What's your choices,
yeah.
I mean, Beck's have got one, I think, isn't it? But they all taste like washing up liquid to me. They've got a funny...
There is a funny aftertaste, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah. Are we allowed to taste some of yours while we're having
absolutely.
A little chat? Now, so you've been going for how long?
So we started brewing back in May.
Okay, so it took quite early on.
Yeah, it took a while to get the brewery set up.
Lucy's just coming over as the producer to help you open the beer on the basis that she then feels she's entitled to have some. That's what she normally does.
I know that Lucy's been on the hard stuff this morning. So
she has actually. Yes. she claims that she was trying some grappa that got sent to the office.
All in the name of work.
Yeah, supposedly. So sorry about that, Becky. So you've only been going recently, less than a year.
Yeah.
Why did you want to actually set up a brewery, a physical space, as you know, as opposed to working with some sort of production outfit that would do it for you?
I guess because alcohol-free is quite a difficult thing to do, and we really just wanted to dedicate ourselves entirely to it, so we could master the getting it right and getting a really good tasting beer that's alcohol-free.
And why actually is it so difficult? Why is it so difficult to crack? What is the normal process? And then what do you have to take out in order to make it happen?
Yeah. Well, the normal process of beer is obviously brewing the malt sugars using the yeast to transform that into alcohol. So by using the same ingredients, it's difficult to stop the yeast from turning the malt sugars into alcohol. So we've had to...
You have to look for a substitute, in essence, then, in order to make that process work.
Yeah, and there's a few different ideas that we're playing around with. Previously, it's always been using normal beer that's got alcohol in it and de-alcoholising it by heating it up. And that can ruin a lot of the flavours, make
it
taste a bit...
burn it out almost.
It can make it taste a bit off.
Is that the way that the major kind of the Beck's and the Heineken's do it?
Most of them. Mm. The other option is by not fermenting it for the same amount of time, which means that you end up with quite sweet liquid, that you still get the malt sugars there. So we've tried to take a different approach and we've played around with different temperatures and different techniques to try and get a really full-bodied, as full-bodied as we can, because obviously alcohol gives beer quite a lot of body.
And quite a bit of the mouthfeel as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you do have to be quite clever with, you know, trying to play around with different things to get more body. The hops, we use really fresh hops to try and get that real freshness in there. Give it a lot of body through the hops.
So we're just tasting the pale ale. I'm going to defer to Guy, who is a little bit of a beer expert.
Expert is a very strong word. I drink a lot of it. And this is very refreshing. And it has got that really kind of familiar, beery, hoppy kind of flavour to it.
It's quite peppy. It's quite...
I tend to prefer drinking ales, which are very still. I'm not really a big lager drinker, but this has got a little bit of a sparkle to it. So it's not completely flat. I think if it was, it would probably taste like there was something missing. And there's already a few things missing in terms of the alcohol content. Really fresh and light and refreshing.
What about you, Ollie?
It feels cleaner.
If
you imagine another pale ale, I think it would be... There's nothing left behind in it.
Yeah,
it's kind of got a very sort of short, clean taste.
Mm. I mean, it's almost reminiscent of drinking a wine rather than a beer in terms of the lightness.
Yeah, I know what you mean by that.
Mm. Really, really interesting. I've tried Nirvana before, actually. I don't think I've had this one, and this is very good.
Yeah, thanks.
And was that what you were trying to achieve?
Yes. So the hops give it a really nice sort of fruity flavour.
It's a little bit light for me, I have to say.
Yeah.
But that's probably because I generally drink quite a lot.
Yeah.
So what else have we got there? So we've got an IPA.
Yeah.
And we've got a stout. And what's the other one? The orangey one.
The Tantra pale ale. Yeah. That's more of a traditional pale ale.
Mm.
So more like your sort of classic cask ales.
Yeah. Can I try your IPA? That's a session beer, isn't it?
And I'm intrigued by the stout. I mean, in terms of, you know, because what we were just talking about, I like it's very light.
If you prefer dark beers, then the stout's the one for you.
Has anyone done a non-alcohol-free stout to date?
We are, I think, the first. There's also another one that's out recently. And there are some from Sweden that I've tasted before, but they're quite uncommon.
And it's the process. Have you had to adopt different processes for different beers in terms of the way you're getting to...
Yeah, so each beer uses slightly different processes and you get slightly different outcomes. Mm. So the balance of malt, sugars, so as you say, the Karma Pale Ale is very light in mouthfeel. The stout, obviously stouts typically are a lot heavier, a lot more full-bodied. So we've used a sort of heavier malt recipe. So you do get the malt sugars a bit stronger in that one, but it helps give it more of a boost in terms of the body.
When I was pregnant about 150 years ago, I just must have had an iron deficiency for some reason, and my body was craving stout. I just used to have only about a quarter of a pint. God, I used to have all this stout all the time. The only thing I can think of, because I never used to drink it before, is that there was obviously the sort of iron and all that sort of content was what my body was lacking.
Yeah. There's a lot of nutrition in beer when you take the alcohol out as well. You get to make the most, your body makes the most.
You heard it here first.
I'm sure that is not the official guidance, by the way, and things have changed a lot since then. But in those days,
I thought the government were recommending that you increase your beer consumption in order to get through the next year.
What, in terms of
topical?
Yes, in terms of Brexit. Yes.
Yeah. Listen, none of this is health advice or guidance, may I say, to anybody that's listening. I'm talking about a long, long time ago. What's your thoughts on that, Ollie? You quite like stout, don't you?
That's more different to a stout than the first one.
It doesn't taste like a stout.
It tastes a bit different.
It's quite chocolatey, actually.
It's quite chocolatey.
Yeah, it's a chocolate stout. And one of the big differences between this one and the other two are that it's a 0.0%. So to get absolutely zero alcohol, we've had to use sort of less yeast or little or no yeast and a few other different techniques. So
I'm intrigued by the 0.0.
Does that mean zero?
No. It's interesting. I mean, look, where, as we all know, in food labelling, you know, you can claim to be a basmati rice if you're 92% basmati, you know, and actually there's a lot of kind of jiggery poker in this. So does alcohol free mean 0.0 or does it mean
0.5?
Yeah, so the labelling is very complicated in this country. In other European countries, 0.5% and below is alcohol free.
I love the Europeans. Yeah. Is it 0.5? So basically if there's a bit of alcohol, it's alcohol free.
But I think it's because it's so difficult to remove all of it. That it would be very challenging for anything to call itself
madness.
That. But
and also that amount of alcohol is actually perfectly fine for...
I think I read somewhere, and it may even have been on the Food Rush, where we wrote a piece about you guys, that it's got the same alcohol quantity as a glass of orange juice.
Exactly, yeah.
What 0.5?
0.5%.
Really? Yeah, what? Fresh juice can have 0.5% alcohol.
Have you been giving now that to your children?
Yeah, now I know why my daughter was sick the other day after a glass of freshly squeezed orange juice.
Is it not off?
No, we were at quite an expensive restaurant. It was described as a bad moment.
Well done.
Oh dear.
Anyway,
can I suggest that one of the target markets there should be the UAE, because the 0.5 wouldn't be allowed in Dubai or Abu Dhabi, and yet a 0.0 would.
Yeah,
That's interesting. Yeah.
Well, I actually like this. I actually like it, but I think it's a thing of its own. I wouldn't describe it as stout.
It's tricky to label it like that.
It's stout-like. But I really
but it makes
like
sense from a marketing point of view.
Taste.
Sorry, can I just go back to the 0.0 and 0.5 thing?
I'm going to have some more on that.
So you're 0.0 in all of your products?
So the stout and our Tantra Pale Ale are both 0.0. And the other two are 0.5.
And picking up the UAE conversation, that's a really interesting one. If we're saying that orange juice contains 0.5% alcohol in certain situations.
Yep. I never knew that. Yeah. I mean, that's.
We need to find the source of that.
Yeah,
is that an April Fool's joke?
No. We interviewed, it must have been Steve, and so it was probably him who said it.
Yeah, that's why the labelling is so tricky, because a can of Sprite can have 0.5% alcohol, but they don't have to say that. And our beers have to say it. And a lot of the time, people's perceptions, they think that 0.5% is going to affect them. they don't realise that by drinking a lot of sugary soft drinks that it's the same.
Which is fascinating, isn't it?
It's absolutely fascinating.
But I guess if you're, you know, you're marketing a low or no alcohol beer, and so people, of course, want to see what the ABV is.
Yeah.
But yeah, really interesting.
That is. I'm astounded by that. So you've got this lovely sort of set of beers now. I do like the stout one. Where are you selling into? Because I know originally you went for crowdfunding and didn't quite get there, but you've had some amazing investor that's phoned you up because they're quite interested. So that's really helped.
Yeah. So it's actually my family. My parents are the ones that really wanted to push this sector. My father's a recovering alcoholic, so he was drinking all the alcohol-free beers and hated them. So he really wanted to do something different. And that's when we met Steve. And we decided to really go for it and put the money in to build a brewery and to get the company off the ground.
And what does he think of your having been? He must be a connoisseur of low alcohol or no alcohol beers. Yeah. So he will really, really be able to tell you about the taste.
He's our number one customer.
Good man. Well, he has to be. He's probably
if he's invested as well. Yeah. Wow.
But it must be so expensive to open a brewery. I mean, there's, you know, to open any business, there's a lot involved. But to, you know, buy all the equipment and the space and everything, it's very challenging,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah, it's a big challenge. But, yeah.
And where are you selling into at the moment?
So, as I said, we started in May. So we're still within our first year of sales. We're now in Whole Foods. Mm-hmm. So there's some Whole Foods stores that stock it. And there's a lot of independent bottle shops around London that are stocking it. And we're starting now to spread out outside of London.
And online?
And online as well, yeah, a few different websites.
Good. And Alistair, do you have any advice? I mean, can you just give us a little bit of background when you started Taywell and then actually, you know, some of the things that you came up against? I mean, you're in a really difficult sector because it's frozen, so that's really, at least theirs is ambient.
Yes, actually, there's a huge advantage to being ambient because especially the smaller supermarkets can stack you at the end of a row temporarily, whereas if you're frozen or you're chilled, you have a fixed space to go into.
Mm, yeah.
So people who are in ambient don't actually appreciate it. But those of us who were in frozen realise that there's an incredible shortage of space of chillers, and they're expensive to run. So the supermarkets or the smaller shops, they don't particularly want them unless they have to have them.
Mm.
However, I think probably, as I've mentioned, I think you've got a very interesting target market out in the dry countries.
Yeah.
And obviously, if there aren't that many companies doing it, then you have a first mover advantage and definitely worth looking at the export market. Some of the companies actually export more than they do domestically. So it doesn't stop you selling in the UK, but you may suddenly find that there's a huge amount of interest in the Arab countries. Yeah.
Do you remember when we had the 10-acre chap whose name escapes me?
Tony something.
He was saying the export market is much easier than you would think, and actually that was a big section of his growth category was you know, because he's doing popcorn and Christmas stuff, was export. So
it's a bit of an untapped resource sometimes.
But I think in the UK there's clearly that, you know, you're the stat absolutely. You started off with, there's a massive movement towards you know, not drinking, teetotaling as kind of choice level, I call it.
Yeah.
But also, I think that, you know, if you walk into your average pub and you're driving or you're not drinking that evening, the choice is appalling.
It's dreadful.
And you know, there are lots of soft drinks that have tried to, you know, address that market with varying degrees of success. But I think what's interesting about this is a beer. It would sit nicely in a pub. Would look at home in a pub. And the reality is, you know, the majority of pubs in this country, people drive to. And, you know, the driving laws are correctly very strict nowadays on alcohol consumption. And therefore, there's a massive market in people who, you know, drive the local pub, have a nice meal. You know, the growth is obviously in, you know, pubs that serve food. So I think in the sort of the pubs that serve food category is a huge opportunity to correctly address that market with something that is not just about the absence of something, the positive of something, because this beer should not be about the fact that it doesn't contain alcohol. It should be about the fact that it's a good drink.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And actually, I think there's always that danger that you end up in the sort of, but we don't have sort of category. And actually, the challenge is, this is a great drink and that's the way to sell it.
Mm. Yeah. I also think we get skewed by London because most people don't have you know, don't drive anywhere in London. You just get on the tube, we get on the bus, get a cab. And of course, all the other major cities and towns around the UK, they're not like that. And that's the real, you know, market for me. It's not necessarily in London.
Which would move me on to suggesting that you ought to talk to some of the drink distributors and see what they think about it. And that one of the problems with being a small company and distribution is that distribution costs are expensive. So if you're going to go out to lots of little pubs, you'd be better off discounting it and selling it in volume to a distributor. And they have an awful lot of experience, and they're the people to target first and say, well, what do you think of that? What would your customers think of that? And can we give it a go?
We still do come up a lot against a lot of sort of distributors and people who think that there isn't a demand. So it's very interesting. A couple of years ago,
I don't think there's a demand.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, there was, you know, the perception of alcohol-free beer is that it tastes awful and only, you know, designated drivers drink it.
Whereas still quite a chunk of society, though.
So things have come a long way.
And also, people don't complain. They don't go in a pub and go, "Blimey, your non-alcoholic provision's rubbish." Because we're British, we don't say anything. But I mean, how many people must think that? A lot of people, I think, a huge number. So and I definitely think it's an interesting market to be in, and it's just going to grow and grow. I'm for sure. So.
But so I think you need to remember with the distribution companies is that they have been brought up on wine, spirits and beers. And so you are fundamentally challenging their business model to say there is an opportunity in the alcohol-free space, because it starts to make them think, oh my word, you know, if 20% of that volume shifted out of, you know, 10, 20 pound bottles of wine, actually it's quite problematic for them, because people will not drink in the volume of liquid. If you play the pure volume game, I'm sure it's the case you would drink less volume of non-alcohol beer than you would have alcohol beer on an evening out, and therefore they will make less margin. So actually they are completely disincentivized from making this trend a reality. So I think it's a real challenge.
And I don't think it's any different to the sugar-free market. So 10 years ago you couldn't have sold anything sugar-free, really, and it didn't take too long for the market to start to change, and I think that would be the same in alcohol-free. But Sue, I agree with you totally. Is I think outside London drink and drive is really quite serious. I think out in the provinces you're going to stand a much better chance.
Out to the provinces, Becky. And over to Arabic countries. Nice advice. So good luck with it. If anybody's interested, they really should have a look. It's Nirvana Brewery, spelled exactly as you would expect, nirvanabrewery.com. I like the stout for that, and have a look at that. I'm gonna try and get a few those, because they're really nice if you are going to visit somebody and you've got to drive. That's my cup of tea. I'm sorry that Steve couldn't be here today. So good luck with Steve as well. Well done, Steve, for setting it up. And you'll be able to find out details of that on our website, of course, but it's nirvanabrewery.com. We're going to have a little break for a few minutes. I've got a really nice little pre-record about wine. So that fits in very well. And as soon as we come back, we're going to be talking to Alistair Jessel. Speak to you in a minute. So I'm here at the Food and Drink Networking Club, which is at the Bakehouse in Tunbridge. I've been invited to this, which is great. I've turned up and I've met this guy called Peter Franz, and Peter's got a load of bottles in front of him, so it looks like I'm going to be tasting wine later, so I'm pretty chuffed about that. Peter set up Sensible Wines, how many years ago, Peter?
24 years now, and getting older and older, and more wines coming onto the world market.
And you're getting wiser in the wine world. So 24 years you've been doing this. And in front of me, I have a Decanter magazine. And I can see on the... it is described as the world's best wine magazine. Not sure if that's true, but it's got a very, very good reputation. And in front of me in this particular edition, it's got the World Wine Awards 2016. I believe you have something to do with the World Wine Awards, Peter, and Sensible Wines.
We certainly do. All the wines at Decanter... nominate to come into us here in Kent. We then sort them out into tasting order. So when the judges are flying from right around the world, we have in front of them something like 17,500 different wines for them to taste, all done in 1 week at the end of April. And every single wine, the 17,500, have to be checked, double checked, bagged, so the judges don't know what they're tasting. And we have a hell of a week up in
I mean, the logistics on that are unbelievable. So you literally can have 18,000 wines. I mean, I don't even know the size of the volume that might take up. And then you somehow have to order them, you know, get them all in the right order. And then you've got English wines here and I mean, is that literally what it's like?
The logistics of it are immense. And in the space of something like 6 weeks, 18,000 of these wines come from everywhere, Japan, China, Australia, all the winemaking regions right around the world. And in that 1 week that we actually taste the wines, we use over 40,000 Riedel wine glasses that we go through. And we have this amazing dishwasher that...
And Riedel wine glasses, most people would say that they are the best glasses. They are the glasses that you should taste wine out of. Is that true in your opinion?
That is very, very true. I think the whole world in the wine world would definitely agree that Riedel glasses are the best. And he makes a selection for Chardonnay, for Pinot Noir, for Tempranillo grape.
So you have different glasses for different wines?
Absolutely.
Does that really affect the taste, seriously?
It is. Actually, next week, Maximilian Riedel is coming over to do a masterclass at the Waldorf, and he demonstrates how each wine is so different in each glass. It's amazing.
And then in terms of the judges, how do they actually taste the wines? Do they literally do what we see on the television, you know, do a little bit of slurping and then spit it out? Or you know, what exactly do they do?
They definitely have to spit it out. I mean,
they'd die otherwise, wouldn't they?
Well, they'd be very alcoholic. they actually taste something like between about 80 and 90 wines per day. And they have them in flights, what we call flights of 12 different wines. So like we've got the English wine Blanc de Blanc from Whiston here, they will taste 12 different English Blanc de Blancs in that sort of price category. All tasted blind, they're all bagged up, they don't know what they're tasting, they all look the same. And they sit there, they'll judge each wine. There's four to a table, and they will then, if they're not quite sure about something, agree between them to sort of maybe retest it, something like that. All the winners then go through to be tasted again. They will then decide, is it worth a gold medal? Is it worth an overall platinum medal?
And do they actually know, do they actually see the labels, or is it a blind tasting?
They never see the labels. We have to bag each individual bottle.
18,000 bottles, that's a lot of bags.
That is a lot of bags. A lot of plastic bags that go around the top so they can't see. There's another one called the Champagne and Sparkling Wine Championships, which actually runs over 2 whole weeks, once again done in Kent. And there's about 800 different wines for that one. So,
and in the 24 years that you've been doing this, have you seen a difference in the sort of connoisseur's attitude toward English wine, both sparkling, you know, and still wine?
Absolutely. I mean, 10 years ago, people were laughing at English wine. And then people like Ridgeview come along. I think the Queen served it at a Golden Jubilee anniversary. And all of a sudden it started taking off. And now the plantings in Kent alone, I think last year there was something like 200 hectares planted in new vines. It's a massive, massive growing market. And even the Champenois are now joining the English sparkling wine revolution. And by buying into vineyards near Canterbury, Tattinger and Pommery have also taken stakes in English wine companies. So,
That's an amazing statement on not only our skills in terms of cultivating vines, but also in terms of climate change. They must be coming over here because the soil and the weather, and possibly working out that there are areas of France that may not be or continue to be prime, you know, Méthode Champenois producing regions.
Definitely. I mean, we have the soils. We've always had the soils. I mean, Romans planted vines in the first place here 2,000 years ago. And there have been vines sort of grown in England in all that time. But it's just the climate change. That's the big difference. Apparently, where we are now is where Champagne was 20 years ago. So Champagne's getting a lot warmer. So people are looking for still the cool climates, which make perfect grapes for perfect sparkling wine.
So in front of us here, we've got four bottles, actually. There's Chapel Down, which I'm very familiar with, and they're putting a lot of investment in, just gone for a very big crowdfunding at the moment. Okay. They've got some still wine there, some red still wine. I have to tell you, Peter, I'm still not a fan of English red wine. I'm sorry. I haven't really. I think it's value for money that is my issue, is that you can get, you know, a £15 bottle of English red wine, and it really, for me, doesn't stack up yet with that equivalent value you can get somewhere else. Whereas I do think definitely that the sort of sparkling wine definitely does.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, I don't agree with it. Although there are one or two very, very good Pinot Noirs out there, especially there's one called Bolney Estate, who won a massive gold medal at last year's decanter. So it's coming. It's going to take a bit more fine weather out there and some winemaking skills to make it. I must admit, there is some half-decent red wines. But again, Chapel Down have actually grown some white wine, Chardonnay, Kitscote, and that is absolutely fantastic. Very limited quantities because of the plantings of the vineyards, but I think it will get massive recognition over the next 2 or 3 years.
But again, Chardonnay probably responds quite well to our chalky soil and you know, that little bit of, you know, the weather being what it is, not quite as hot.
Yeah, exactly. But don't forget, Pinot Noir also goes into making sparkling wine. So it, and some of the roses have won international recognition. So Pinot Noir is getting there. It might take one or two more higher temperatures to get.
So you think we're going to start with Pinot Noir in this country and probably move on to Shiraz and all that later on?
I don't know if we'll ever get down to the Shiraz level, but definitely Pinot Noir is definitely the way to go with some red wines.
Well, that's brilliant. Thank you, Peter France from Sensible Wines. Your last comment, any tips for the future in terms of wine that you're seeing, or any trends?
There's lots of new trends coming through, but I think the Chinese will hit the market very, very shortly in a big, big way.
You really believe that? The Chinese? You must be seeing stuff then.
Yes, we've had... 3 years ago, we had about 4 entries from China. Last year, we actually had, I think, about 24. And so, you know, and their next generation of winemaker have done all their studying in Bordeaux. So watch Bordeaux blend Chinese wine coming.
Watch this space, because they're not going to do it by halves, are they?
Oh, no, they'll do it in a massive way.
Peter France, thank you very much. And if anybody wants to know about Sensible Wines, if you go onto the foodtalk.co.uk website, you can read all about Peter there. Thank you. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you very much.
Hello there. My name is Sue Nelson, and I'm the presenter on the Food Talk show. Last year, in June, we held our first Food Talk Awards. We had the most incredible time. We had amazing people applying for the awards. It allowed them to market themselves better. It allowed them to get new business. It allowed them to get new buyers. And generally, it did their business the world of good. I'd really like you to apply this year if you're doing something new and interesting. We've got all sorts of categories, from just stuff that tastes amazing to free from food. Food that's really been designed for clean eating, taking everything nasty out of it. Or you might have a smart kitchen gadget, or you're doing amazing things in the world of packaging. We'd love you to apply. The closing date is Friday the 16th of February, midnight, in case you're one of those people who leave it to the last minute. And we really do feel it gives people the most incredible publicity. Not only do you get a shiny gold award and the right to call yourself a Food Talk Award winner, we will feature you in an episode of the Food Talk show, which would be great. It means you can join us here in our studio. So please do consider entering the Food Talk Awards. You've got till Friday the 16th of February, and you need to go on to our website, which is foodtalkawards.com, or just go on to our foodtalk.co.uk site and you'll find all about it there. Good luck, make sure you apply. And there you go. And don't forget, you really do need to enter our Food Talk Awards. It's a great evening. We're so excited already. It's ages yet, but we've already got loads of packages that have started arriving in the office that are being stuffed in the fridge and the freezer. And we've got a Kirk and you need to get your stuff in if you can. It's great marketing if you can get an award. We know it's helped some of our winners last year actually get on the television and get into supermarkets and all sorts of things. So please do enter. It's free. If you need any help
entering the awards for any reason, just ring our office and it's all on the website, and we can see if we can give you a hand if you're struggling with it. But it should be nice and simple.
It's only a couple of weeks ago, I think, isn't it? So the deadline closes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Put a bit of pressure on.
Haven't got long. So, Alistair, you're very experienced in the food sector with your table ice cream. And obviously you're based in Kent, of which I am too. I've been talking to quite a lot of organisations, businesses and councils recently about getting a food tech, not just food, food tech hub into the UK. So we can go and trot along to Borough Market or the lovely Mercato Metropolitano, Elephant Castle. And I've been to see, you know, people in Camden and Westminster, and please, can we have a food tech hub? But also been talking to the likes of Pepsi and Unilever, others like that. And the reason why I'm so keen on trying to find a way of doing this is we see on this programme people are doing amazing, innovative types of food stuff, not just production, but, you know, in food analytics and packaging and all sorts of other things. They get so far, and then instead of there being a lovely little curve where you suddenly grow, it's always a step change. And the step change is very expensive and very risky. And at that point, it's when you have to go and get a property and make some investment, or go to a contract producer and make an investment. And it all starts to get very, very business-like, as opposed to I'm selling X amount, you know, through these other channels. And for me, that's where quite a lot of it falls down. And we don't see some of the innovation that could come through. And I think that these people need very specific things. So they want somewhere that is, you know, conforms to health and safety legislation, where they can do a bit of trial production, where they can talk to other people, where they can maybe do some short run packaging, maybe where they can get some help and advice by from other people. And I'm struggling to get anybody to listen to me. So, Alistair, I'm rather hoping you might have got a bit further than I have.
Yes, I think it came out of my experience in growing my ice cream business from a small 25-metre kitchen on my farm. And when I sold the farm and I needed to move somewhere else, I started to look around and I actually couldn't find anywhere. It wasn't a question of moving on to any old farm in Kent. I just couldn't find premises. So in the end, I had to convert another industrial building that I had from my previous business, which was actually in the stone industry, and turning an old stone building into a kitchen ended up costing me £200,000. And that obviously included the freezers and fridges and all sorts of other bits of equipment. But it was an incredible investment. And if I look back on it now, I think actually it was a terrible waste of money. And I think that had I spent the £200,000 wisely, I could probably build a much better building. And that got me to thinking about, well, if I've struggled with it, especially in the frozen food industry, because freezers do cost a lot of money, I suddenly thought, well, if I'm struggling with it, I'm sure every other food company is struggling with it, because if I can't find premises, they must struggle too. Now, a lot of people end up going onto a farm and they go into a unit, which is all very well if you're supplying to your local shops and you're doing little food outlets. But when you grow and you end up looking at the supermarkets, they come and visit you and they sort of smile and they say, well, we can tolerate this for a little while, but I'm afraid in the next year or so, you're going to have to get a BRC grade AA building, and you're going to have to up your output a lot more. And if you're not prepared to do that, we can do you on the local side. So like Waitrose Local, where you supply a number of local Waitrose shops, like 20 or 30 or 40 or so. But that tends to be much smaller business, and you don't get the promotion that you'd get if you were going into a big supermarket and going nationwide. And I'll be honest,
chicken and egg, isn't it?
It is terrible chicken and egg. And in fact, I'll be honest that I went up about 8 years ago for a completely different reason, 7 years ago, to look at a food hub up in Nottingham. Now, Nottingham currently has the only food hub in the country where food manufacturers can go. And it's a very interesting concept, but obviously they don't provide the sort of the BRC grade. It's just a set of buildings suitable for food and drink
It's almost like one of these enterprise units.
It's an enterprise unit, yeah. So that got me thinking. And then in the last year or so, I sort of thought, well, we really must do something about it. It's all very well thinking about it. And we all know that there's a problem, but who's doing anything about it? So I approached Kent's largest housing builder. And I said, look, I've got this idea about building some units. And he said, oh, well, units don't pay. And I said, I know units don't pay because, of course, houses are so valuable that the land values anywhere in London or in the home counties can range somewhere between £500,000 and £1 million an acre. And actually, if you're going to build some tin sheds, it just doesn't pay to spend £500,000.
So the economics of that just doesn't work. They don't get any payback.
But if you're going to build a few beautiful houses that you can sell off at £1.5 million each, it does pay. So I talked to him about it, and there's a lot more interest now in the government to build small sort of town likes where you build sort of 1,000 houses, have a little hospital, have a church, have a sports ground, have all sorts of things.
So there's an infrastructure around it.
Yes. Yeah. So I think if you're going to meet the government's 200,000 houses a year to be built, there needs to be business parks built with the houses so that the businesses can tie in with however many thousand houses are going to be built around it. And that's where I'm looking at is obviously I've found a builder, I've found a site, I found a convenient site, and I talked to him about it. And as a concept, it's great. In terms of what we were offer would be all the things that I lacked, which was freezer space. So there'll be a whole unit devoted.
Or fridge space, depending on what you're doing. Yeah.
Fridge space, a unit for fridge, a unit for freezer, a unit for packaging. Now, people, when they go into the food industry, think, oh, I've got 50 metres or 100 metres. That's great. There's going to be more than enough for me to make fudge or make some cookies or whatever. And then they go, right, we've got six different products. So there's six different types of packaging.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking here, aren't we, at Becky's beers. I mean, she's got five different ones here. So
all of a sudden, the space required for packaging is greater than your entire production area. Mm. And you think, well, this is crazy, but that's the food industry. So I had about 40 different ice creams. So I had tubs and bases, and I had 125 mil, 500 litres. So you start multiplying it up. You're talking a very large amount of packaging.
And storage.
So I thought a complete unit that where you can actually rent by the pallet load per week would be a great idea. So the idea is that being able to rent rather than spend a lot, because when you get into the food industry, the capital costs of setting up are large enough anyway. If you're going to have to spend £100,000 to build your own unit before you spend another £100,000 on the equipment, before you spend another £100,000 on marketing, you can see why everyone has to go to raise money. Yeah. But if you don't have to spend the capital and you can just rent, you can save that and put the money into marketing.
And one of the things also, I must say, talking to some of the bigger food manufacturers is they know that they can't innovate internally. They're really reaching that conclusion pretty soonish now. I really do think they've reached that point. They try, but it's very, very expensive. And I do think they want to come on some of the ones that I've been talking to. They want to come on these discovery days. They want to see what people are doing. They want to bring their team and get them thinking differently. And I know a lot of the big food manufacturers are quite interested in, well, they probably won't put their money where their mouth is, but they're quite interested in trying to support that type of concept so that we can get these alternatives out into supermarkets and into the mainstream.
So you're so right that the big companies are terrible at innovation. If they can, they'll just copy. Obviously, it's a lot cheaper for them just to buy the business.
But when I talk to some of the innovation engineers in these big companies, they've got great ideas. They're just not allowed to do them because it's too much of a risk. Yes. And they just get killed later on down the line. I mean, you've seen that, haven't you, Ollie, in when you've been working at places like Unilever. It's not that people don't have good ideas. It's the, I don't know, it's the culture.
I always remember there was a great process they used to run at Unilever, they probably still do, where in order to launch something, you had to get a certain percentage of people to agree with, you know, it's called top box ranking, which was, you know, extremely likely to buy or likely to buy. And the percentage was like over 60%. Mm. Right? But the reality is that the penetration targets for these brands was like 5 to 7%. So you're basically having to get agreement on something that actually is never going to happen. So I think part of it is they have these systems and processes which are designed to be impossible unless you're doing such a mass market thing, which is why what you can't do is create something small and then build it and build it and build it. Because a lot of this stuff, you know, let's take the alcohol-free beer conversation from a second ago. It's very hard to, you know, if you had to do the justification of why should you launch an alcohol-free beer? Yeah, there's some good data points about drink driving and about, you know, the number of people who are teetotalers nowadays. But they'd say, well, it's not big enough. Let's just launch another bit. Let's launch a new variant. And that's the problem, I think, with a lot of these things, is that the barriers that are put in place are so enormous that
so what you're saying is they're happier with a slight variation on something they're comfortable with than something completely new.
It's easier, and also, I mean, the runway to get an idea, you know, if you take Fevertree, it's taken them 13 years to build that brand. Now, yeah. But it's 13 yeah. years. 13 years is a really, really long time in the eyes of a Unilever. I mean, that probably would involve 7.5 new brand managers, right? So you don't have a consistent team. You have a ranging group of people who are moving through their careers. And so ultimately, no one's responsible for it. Strategy changes, interests change. And so there isn't the love and care that you get from renting a space, taking over a brand and saying, you know what, I'm going to put my family money or, you know, friends' money behind an idea and make it happen. It's different mindsets, different set of processes, and it's a different set of pressures.
And what you're suggesting, Alistair, is having this halfway house where you're not selling the whole family silver in order to invest in that. You know, there's a like, I mean, you've got to invest something, obviously, but it's not as unattainable.
I think you're going to use the money for investing in the food itself, in the manufacturing equipment itself. It's not just food, I'm talking about drink as well, so people could manufacture drink there. But most of all, I wanted to spin things off and end up with a test kitchen or possibly two test kitchens where chefs can come and try out their new recipes. And if we could have seating of around about 200 people, that would allow people to do a complete test kitchen, try it out, have 150 people sitting there and talking about the food and tasting it and saying yes or no, it will work or it won't work. Hmm. Yeah. And of course, having had a kitchen where I was producing dairy-free ice cream whilst I was producing dairy ice cream, we had to shut down production, we had to stop for a day, we had to clean all the equipment, we had to completely shut the process down just to try something. Whereas if you've got a test kitchen, you carry on manufacturing, you rent the test kitchen, it has all the latest equipment, you can do a short-term run, give it a go, see what it's like, and not contaminate anything in your
kitchen. And it doesn't hurt your turnover.
And it doesn't hurt your turnover.
And I think that's a really important point as well about bringing people in, potential consumers or, you know, existing customers to try the new things, because I think something else that's really missing from the smaller producers is they don't have that kind of line of communication and dialogue with potential customers or existing customers to get valuable feedback about what's working, what's not working, is the taste profile right, is the
because it's always your mates
right.
Or your mum, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. And they're just going to go, biased. Yeah, brilliant.
Slightly biased.
The only the only pushback on that is, I think, you know, when you meet your average founder who's created a business, what they're really good at doing is being out there on the weekend, you know, sampling and doing things. So I think they don't get what I'll call formal testing,
no,
but sure. They are much better versus your average brand manager who definitely is not doing this, is out there doing sampling in the whole, I mean, I bet you do this. You go to Whole Foods, you do sampling, and you look a certain number of people in the eye week in, week out, and they go, don't like that. And so you're getting a much more immediate feedback network than you might in the more what I call big manufactured way. And you need both.
Is that what you've been doing?
Yeah, okay, absolutely. Yeah. Our founder, Steve, went to Whole Foods last week and to do a taster, and, you know, I was out in the farm shop doing the same thing.
Getting that feedback. So we've also had Kitchup on the programme, who are doing very, very well at the moment. And what Kitchup are doing in London is they're identifying restaurants and other types of catering space that's free in the evening or at weekends or whatever. And they've got a very lively, good business going on where people are almost like Airbnb, actually, Airbnb for test kitchening.
Yeah, it's a great...
and it's going really well. Yeah. So it does show, Alistair, isn't it, that there's a real need for it. People are, you know, people are renting these spaces because they're trying them out, which is a, you know, good way of doing it.
Yes, I think the whole idea behind the Kent Food and Drink Hub was to provide facilities, a bit like the big yellow building or the storage company, where everything's there, you know, the sellotape, the boxes, absolutely everything that you need to start or to expand your food business is already in place. All you have to do is turn up, rent a space, and as you grow, there are enough buildings there
to take on more and
to
more.
Take on more and more buildings and to grow and grow and grow and grow until you say, okay, I need an 8,000 square foot factory, I'll go and build my own somewhere else.
And that's a success story, isn't it? Because you've taken that person all the way through that journey to the point where they are successful and they don't need you anymore.
Yes, I think the aim was to start with a sort of 1,000 square foot units and upwards, so maybe 1,000, 2,000, and 3,000 square foot units, do a number of them, probably more in the 1,000 side, and then people can say, okay, at the moment I'm in a 100 square meter kitchen. In a couple of years' time, I'm really going to have to move. Those are the people I'm looking for, people who want growths, people who are looking to supply the supermarkets in the future or to grow their existing business, but also people who get together and say, well, I've got this great idea. I want to make such and such a thing, but I just don't know where to start.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a hub for creative people to sit down in 200 seats as well and talk to each other.
And how far along are you with this? Does it actually exist now? Where are you based? Is it just in your head?
No, it's quite far down the road. We actually go in for planning permission in a few months' time. So we're talking a very, very large area for development. The aim is to take the 5 acres and to do it in two phases. So sort of a 2.5 acre first phase and a 2.5 acre second phase. And it's going to be based near Maidstone, down in Kent. And if we get planning permission, away it goes. If we don't get planning permission, we just have to keep looking. But the problem is that the cost of land in the home counties is so expensive.
Yeah,
if you're going to have to spend £600,000, £700,000, £800,000 an acre, you can't justify it. So you've got to find either some land that's you think you can get planning or land that's close to a motorway. But trust me, I spent months and months and months looking, and it's extremely hard. And I've contacted all sorts of people in the industry. And the answer is nobody wants to build sheds because houses are more valuable.
Yeah. Mm.
Are we seeing more of this kind of stuff in America and in the rest of Europe? Because I came across one in northern Italy, which I think was done by a private equity firm who were interested in the food space. I'll dig out their name. But they were specifically, they'd built this kind of thing, but they'd done it because the return was not about the return on land values. Mm. Return was based on the return of equity investment.
And this is where I think that sometimes that's where government does help, because it needs to be kick-started. Because I don't think the private sector would initially, and so somehow for me it feels like it's the sort of thing that maybe local government or government should be helping with, because it could be part of a tourist destination, it could be part of other parts of their strategy, or supporting new businesses, growing new businesses, creating jobs. Mm. I'm not sure the private sector on its own can make this happen.
But it's interesting if you change the return about being the return on land value, and you do the return on investment in terms of a pure equity investment, well, if you're building a whole collection of really interesting food business of the future and you're the seed funder, huge potential.
Yeah,
and actually the numbers completely add up and you'd have no issue with it.
Yes.
But you're dealing with a completely different model there. It's a private equity driven model.
But one of the problems that we haven't discussed is getting planning permission.
Yeah. Mm.
And the thing is that the councils simply don't want to risk the wrath of the local population and their seats on the council by voting for something that's going to be an industrial unit with lorries.
They seem okay with fracking in certain parts.
That's different.
There's another project that I've heard of, which is happening in New Covent Garden Market, where they're doing a similar kind of thing, but they're also putting in more permanent office space, I think, for service providers as well as the growers and the producers. And so, I mean, that could be a way to, you know, aid the issue of, you know, like a lumpy business model where you've got people coming in and renting and stuff like
actually,
that.
Actually, I had that already planned. Ah, so one of the things with food production, you need to be on ground level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I noticed that in most industrial buildings, there's room for a mezzanine floor. So if you're going to build something, you build it with two floors and you have the office upstairs. Yeah. Well, if you're going to have a hub, you could have a whole lot of factory workspace downstairs and probably 25 to 30, 25 meter offices upstairs. Mm. And so you could have people in the service industry who look after food companies. So consultants, you could have chefs, you could have accountants, you could have all sorts of people who will rent a small office.
Because they want to be in that
community.
Absolutely.
I'm terribly sorry, but we've run out of time. So if anyone wants to find out about Alistair's project, it's kentfoodanddrinkhub.co.uk. A really important piece of work, very much behind what you're doing. I think we should see more of these around, really. And home counties in London's quite difficult because of the cost of land, I guess. But it is needed, isn't it? I mean, it's definitely
there's
needed.
Demand.
Yeah, definitely.
And we've seen more of these, you know, they're all over London. There are now shared office spaces where there are small tech startups working together. You walk into them, there will be 50 brands on the wall.
Funny enough, if I can just interrupt and say that the developer actually has one site in Bromley.
Oh, there you go. So thank you so much for joining us, Alistair. KentFoodAndDrinkHub.co.uk. We're going to keep tabs on that because we're really, really interested in to see how it's going. And I've just finished your stout. Thank you, Becky. Becky Keane. NirvanaBrewery.com. You can find all of that information on our website, as you can all the stuff to do with Alistair. You've been listening to the Food Talk Show, and we're now syndicated, as you know, everywhere. I won't bother going into that anymore. Thank you to my fellow presenters, Guy Routledge of Sapling Digital and co-founder of The Food Rush.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Feel myself moving to the new sort of Alistair's Food Hub. I'd quite like that.
Sounds brilliant.
Mm. And again, thank you to Ollie Lloyd. We're really excited about your research next week. We're going to be going through that for Great British Chefs, aren't we?
Likewise.
Excellent. Let's see what's happening. And if you want to get in touch with us via Twitter, it's on @foodtalkshow. And if you want to listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts, please go to foodtalk.co.uk. Have a good week. Enter the Food Talk Awards and join us next week for Ollie's research. See you now. Thank you.